Chapter 26. Some years ago, a temporary inability to sleep, referable to a distressing impression, caused me to walk about the streets all night, for a series of several nights. The disorder might have taken a long time to conquer if it had been faintly experimented on in bed, but it was soon defeated by the brisk treatment of getting up directly after lying down, and going out, and coming home tired at sunrise. In the course of those nights, I finished my education in a fair amateur experience of houselessness. My principal object being to get through the night, the pursuit of it brought me into sympathetic relations with people who have no other object every night in the year. The month was March, and the weather damp, cloudy, and cold. The sun not rising before 5:30, the night perspective looked sufficiently long at 12:30, which was about my time for confronting it. The restlessness of a great city, and the way in which it tumbles and tosses before it can get to sleep, formed one of the first entertainments offered to the contemplation of us houseless people. It lasted about 2 hours. We lost a great deal of companionship when the late public houses turned their lamps out, and when the potman thrust the last brawling drunkards into the street, but stray vehicles and stray people were left us after that. If we were very lucky, a policeman's rattle sprang, and a fray turned up, but, in general, surprisingly little of this diversion was provided. Except in the Haymarket, which is the worst-kept part of London, and about Kent Street in the borough, and along a portion of the line of the old Kent Road, the peace was seldom violently broken. But, it was always the case that London, as if in imitation of individual citizens belonging to it, had expiring fits and starts of restlessness. After all seemed quiet, if one cab rattled by, half a dozen would surely follow, and houselessness even observed that intoxicated people appeared to be magnetically attracted towards each other, so that we knew when we saw one drunken object staggering against the shutters of a shop, that another drunken object would stagger up before 5 minutes were out, to fraternize or fight with it. When we made a divergence from the regular species of drunkard, the thin-armed, puff-faced, leaden-lipped gin drinker, and encountered a rarer specimen of a more decent appearance, 50-to-1, but that specimen was dressed in soiled mourning. As the street experience in the night, so the street experience in the day, the common folk who come unexpectedly into a little property, come unexpectedly into a deal of liquor. At length these flickering sparks would die away, worn out the last veritable sparks of waking life trailed from some late pieman, or hot potato man, and London would sink to rest. And then the yearning of the houseless mind would be for any sign of company, any lighted place, any movement, anything suggestive of anyone being up, nay, even so much as awake, for the houseless eye looked out for lights in windows. Walking the streets under the pattering rain, houselessness would walk, and walk and walk, seeing nothing but the interminable tangle of streets, save at a corner, here and there, two policemen in conversation, or the sergeant or inspector looking after his men. Now and then in the night, but rarely, houselessness would become aware of a furtive head peering out of a doorway a few yards before him, and, coming up with the head, would find a man standing bolt upright to keep within the doorway's shadow, and evidently intent upon no particular service to society. Under a kind of fascination, and in a ghostly silence suitable to the time, houselessness and this gentleman would eye one another from head to foot, and so, without exchange of speech, part, mutually suspicious. Drip, 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 from ledge and coping, splash from pipes and water spouts, and by the houseless shadow would fall upon the stones that pave the way to Waterloo Bridge, it being in the houseless mind to have a halfpenny worth of excuse for saying good night to the toll keeper and catching a glimpse of his fire. A good fire and a good great coat, and a good woolen neck shawl, were comfortable things to see in conjunction with the toll keeper, Also his brisk wakefulness was excellent company when he rattled the change of halfpence down upon that metal table of his, like a man who defied the night, with all its sorrowful thoughts, and didn't care for the coming of dawn. There was need of encouragement on the threshold of the bridge, for the bridge was dreary. The chopped-up murdered man had not been lowered with a rope over the parapet when those nights were. He was alive, and slept then quietly enough most likely, and undisturbed by any dream of where he was to come. But the river had an awful look, the buildings on the banks were muffled in black shrouds, and the reflected light seemed to originate deep in the water, as if the specters of suicides were holding them to show where they went down. The wild moon and clouds were as restless as an evil conscience in a tumbled bed, and the very shadow of the immensity of London seemed to lie oppressively upon the river. Between the bridge and the two great theatres, there was but the distance of a few hundred paces, so the theatres came next. Grim and black within, at night, those great dry wells, and lonesome to imagine, with the rows of faces faded out, the lights extinguished, and the seats all empty. One would think that nothing in them knew itself at such a time but the Yorick's skull. In one of my night walks, as the church steeples were shaking the March winds, and rain with the strokes of four, I passed the outer boundary of one of these great deserts, and entered it. With a dim lantern in my hand, I groped my well-known way to the stage, and looked over the orchestra which was like a great grave dug for a time of pestilence into the void beyond. A dismal cavern of an immense aspect, with the chandelier gone dead like everything else, and nothing visible through mist and fog and space, but tiers of winding sheets. The ground at my feet where, when last there, I had seen the peasantry of Naples dancing among the vines, reckless of the burning mountain which threatened to overwhelm them, was now in possession of a strong serpent of engine hose, watchfully lying in wait for the serpent fire, and ready to fly at it, if it showed its forked tongue. A ghost of a watchman, carrying a faint corpse candle, haunted the distant upper gallery and flitted away. Retiring within the proscenium, and holding my light above my head towards the rolled-up curtain green no more, but black as ebony my sight lost itself in a gloomy vault, showing faint indications in it of a shipwreck of canvas and cordage. Method I felt much as a diver might, at the bottom of the sea. In those small hours, when there was no movement in the streets, it afforded matter for reflection, to take Newgate in the way, and, touching its rough stone, to think of the prisoners in their sleep, and then to glance in at the lodge over the spiked wicket, and see the fire and light of the watching turnkeys, on the white wall. Not an inappropriate time either, to linger by that wicked little debtor's door shutting tighter than any other door one ever saw which has been death's door to so many. In the days of the uttering of forged £1 notes by people tempted up from the country, how many hundreds of wretched creatures of both sexes, many quite innocent, swung out of a pitiless and inconsistent world, with the tower of yonder Christian church of St. Sepulchre monstrously before their eyes. Is there any haunting of the bank parlor, by the remorseful souls of old directors, in the nights of these later days, I wonder, or is it as quiet as this degenerate asoldama of an Old Bailey? To walk onto the bank, lamenting the good old times and bemoaning the present evil period, would be an easy next step, so I would take it, and would make my houseless circuit of the bank, and give a thought to the treasure within. Likewise to the guard of soldiers passing the night there, and nodding over the fire. Next, I went to Billingsgate, in some hope of market people, but it proving as yet too early, crossed London Bridge, and got down by the waterside on the Surrey shore among the buildings of the great brewery. There was plenty going on at the brewery, and the reek, and the smell of grains, and the rattling of the plump dray horses at their mangers, were capital company. Quite refreshed by having mingled with this good society, I made a new start with a new heart, setting the old King's Bench prison before me for my next object, and resolving, when I should come to the wall, to think of poor Horace Kinch, and the dry rot in men. A very curious disease, the dry rot in men, and difficult to detect the beginning of. It had carried Horace Kinch inside the wall of the old King's Bench prison, and it had carried him out with his feet foremost. He was a likely man to look at, in the prime of life, well-to-do, as clever as he needed to be, and popular among many friends. He was suitably married, and had healthy and pretty children. But, like some fair-looking houses or fair-looking ships, he took the dry rot. The first strong external revelation of the dry rot in men is a tendency to lurk and lounge, to be at street corners without intelligible reason, to be going anywhere when met, to be about many places, rather than at any, to do nothing tangible, but to have an intention of performing a variety of intangible duties tomorrow, or the day after. When this manifestation of the disease is observed, the observer will usually connect it with a vague impression once formed or received, that the patient was living a little too hard. He will scarcely have had leisure to turn it over in his mind, and form the terrible suspicion dry rot, apostrophe when he will notice a change for the worse in the patient's appearance. A certain slovenliness and deterioration, which is not poverty, nor dirt, nor intoxication, nor ill health, but simply dry rot. To this, succeeds a smell, as of strong waters, in the morning, to that, a looseness respecting money, to that, a stronger smell, as of strong waters, at all times, to that, a looseness respecting everything. To that, a trembling of the limbs, somnolency, misery, and crumbling to pieces. As it is in wood, so it is in men. Dry rot advances at a compound usury quite incalculable. A plank is found infected with it, and the whole structure is devoted. Thus it had been with the unhappy Horace Kinch, lately buried by a small subscription. Those who knew him had not nigh done saying, so well off, so comfortably established, with such hope before him, and yet, it is feared, with a slight touch of dry rot. Apostrophe, apostrophe, when lo, the man was all dry rot and dust. From the dead wall associated on those houseless nights with this too common story, I chose next to wander by Bethlehem Hospital, partly because it lay on my road round to Westminster, partly because I had a night fancy in my head which could be best pursued within sight of its walls and dome. And the fancy was this. Are not the sane and the insane equal at night as the sane lie a-dreaming? Are not all of us outside this hospital, who dream, more or less in the condition of those inside it, every night of our lives? Are we not nightly persuaded, as they daily are, that we associate preposterously with kings and queens, emperors and empresses, and notabilities of all sorts? Do we not nightly jumble events, and personages and times and places, as these do daily? Are we not sometimes troubled by our own sleeping inconsistencies, and do we not vexedly try to account for them or excuse them, just as these do sometimes in respect of their waking delusions? Said an afflicted man to me, when I was last in a hospital like this, sir, I can frequently fly. Apostrophe, I was half ashamed to reflect that so could I by night. Said a woman to me on the same occasion, Queen Victoria frequently comes to dine with me, and Her Majesty and I dine off peaches and macaroni in our nightgowns, and His Royal Highness the Prince Consort does us the honor to make a third on horseback in a field marshal's uniform. Apostrophe, could I refrain from reddening with consciousness, when I remembered the amazing royal parties I myself had given at night, the unaccountable viands I had put on table, and my extraordinary manner of conducting myself on those distinguished occasions? I wonder that the great master who knew everything, when he called sleep the death of each day's life, did not call dreams the insanity of each day's sanity. By this time I had left the hospital behind me, and was again setting towards the river, and in a short breathing space I was on Westminster Bridge, regaling my houseless eyes with the external walls of the British Parliament, the perfection of a stupendous institution, I know, and the admiration of all surrounding nations and succeeding ages, I do not doubt, but perhaps a little the better now, and then for being pricked up to its work. turning off into Old Palace Yard. The courts of law kept me company for a quarter of an hour, hinting in low whispers what numbers of people they were keeping awake, and how intensely wretched and horrible they were rendering the small hours to unfortunate suitors. Westminster Abbey was fine gloomy society for another quarter of an hour, suggesting a wonderful procession of its dead among the dark arches and pillars, each century more amazed by the century following it than by all the centuries going before. And indeed in those houseless night walks which even included cemeteries, where watchmen went round among the graves at stated times, and moved the telltale handle of an index which recorded that they had touched it at such an hour, it was a solemn consideration what enormous hosts of dead belonged to one old great city, and how, if they were raised while the living slept, there would not be the space of a pin's point in all the streets and ways for the living to come out into. Not only that, but the vast armies of dead would overflow the hills and valleys beyond the city, and would stretch away all round it, God knows how far. When a church clock strikes, on houseless ears, in the dead of the night, it may be at first mistaken for company and hailed as such. But, as the spreading circles of vibration, which you may perceive at such a time with great clearness, go opening out, forever and ever afterwards widening perhaps, as the philosopher has suggested, an eternal space, the mistake is rectified, and the sense of loneliness is profounder. Once it was after leaving the abbey, and turning my face north I came to the great steps of St. Martin's Church as the clock was striking three. Suddenly, a thing that in a moment more I should have trodden upon without seeing, rose up at my feet with a cry of loneliness and houselessness, struck out of it by the bell, the like of which I never heard. We then stood face to face looking at one another, frightened by one another. The creature was like a beetle-browed hair-lipped youth of 20, and it had a loose bundle of rags on, which it held together with one of its hands. It shivered from head to foot, and its teeth chattered, and as it stared at me, persecutor, devil, ghost, whatever it thought me, it made with its whining mouth, as if it were snapping at me, like a worried dog. Intending to give this ugly object money, I put out my hand to stay it, for it recoiled as it whined and snapped, and laid my hand upon its shoulder. Instantly, it twisted out of its garment, like the young man in the New Testament, and left me standing alone with its rags in my hands. Covent Garden Market, when it was market morning, was wonderful company. The great wagons of cabbages, with growers' men and boys lying asleep under them, and with sharp dogs from market garden neighborhoods looking after the whole, were as good as a party. But one of the worst night sights I know in London is to be found in the children who prowl about this place, who sleep in the baskets, fight for the offal, dart at any object they think they can lay their thieving hands on, dive under the carts and barrows, dodge the constables, and are perpetually making a blunt pattering on the pavement of the piazza with the rain of their naked feet. A painful and unnatural result comes of the comparison one is forced to institute between the growth of corruption as displayed in the so much improved and cared for fruits of the earth, and the growth of corruption as displayed in these all uncared for, except in as much as ever hunted, savages. There was early coffee to be got about Covent Garden Market, and that was more company, warm company too, which was better. Toast of a very substantial quality was likewise procurable, though the tousled-headed man who made it, in an inner chamber within the coffee room, hadn't got his coat on yet, and was so heavy with sleep, that in every interval of toast and coffee he went off anew behind the partition in two complicated crossroads of choke and snore, and lost his way directly. Into one of these establishments, among the earliest, near Bow Street, there came one morning as I sat over my houseless cup, pondering where to go next, a man in a high and long snuff-colored coat and shoes, and, to the best of my belief, nothing else but a hat, who took out of his hat a large cold meat pudding, a meat pudding so large that it was a very tight fit, and brought the lining of the hat out with it. This mysterious man was known by his pudding, for on his entering, the man of sleep brought him a pint of hot tea, a small loaf, and a large knife and fork and plate. Left to himself in his box, he stood the pudding on the bare table, and, instead of cutting it, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.